Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, after way too long a time, is writer and historian Jill Watts. She is a professor of history at California State University, San Marcos, and we're talking about her new book, The Black Cabinet, The Untold Story of African Americans in Politics During the Age of Roosevelt. Jill, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you after all these years.
Oh, thank you, Mark, for having me back. I'm really, really looking forward to our conversation.
You wrote two other great books that we covered, and I had no idea you had this in you. I mean this in the best sort of way. This is a monumental history that just sort of blew my mind. It's a history that most of us sadly don't know. How did you come to this subject matter?
Well, I kind of have you to thank for it because you had encouraged me along to write a biography of Will Hayes.
And I'm so still waiting for it.
Yeah.
That'll be your next book.
Okay. And you know he's so important because of censorship, but he's also important because he was a political figure before he got into Hollywood censorship. And so I have that first part of his political aspect done, I hate to say, but I got into the 20s when he's just about to become film censor. This is a long answer to this question. It's thanks to you. I came across these documents of African-American appointees who had been under Roosevelt and Taft writing to him saying, okay, the Republicans are back in, and so we assume that the party is going to see that we get these appointments. And they don't. They don't
get
those appointments at all. And at that moment, when I saw those documents, I started thinking, oh my gosh, you know, there's the black cabinet under FDR, but there's definitely not one under Hoover, Coolidge, and Harding. And so I started percolating that. And then I have to say also, the Obama election, it was January, just before his inauguration, Dorothy Height, who was a disciple of Mary McLeod Bethune, who was a leader in the Black Cabinet, her comment about it took a lot of people, a lot of work to get here. And I just thought, oh, the Black Cabinet of the 30s, they are the lost generation. They're the, you know, now we'd say hidden figures of American political history. So that really inspired me to pursue it.
It's a complicated history. And for the benefit of the audience, I want to say we cannot possibly do this book justice. But it needs to be read. And I mean that in the best sort of way. I couldn't put the book down. I had to keep reading because it's a fascinating history. And by no means is it all like positive and uplifting. It's a constant battle from these black politicians in the cabinet to try to get things done. There's some wins. There's some definite losers. But it's an amazing thing because I want you to comment on it. They looked at this time of the 30s, a time of economic and social crisis, the Depression, as, okay, this is a time where if we can get into the government and sort of influence certain people, we could remake the United States to finally extend equal rights to all Americans.
Right. I think that that's one of their big victories in terms of their tenure in the federal government. I mean, they have a lot of victories.
They did.
They segregate federal office space. They fight for equal relief for African-American people. I mean, they stopped the starving in many communities, although starving continued in others. But the thing about it is that they have a vision for the New Deal that even the most dedicated white New Dealers don't have for it early on. They see that the New Deal can become a broader philosophy of governing with the idea that no American is forgotten, not just economically, but in terms of their political rights and their social rights. And so that the New Deal opens the door to recreate America in an integrationist vision, which is something that all of them held before they entered government. So they came into government with this philosophy and realized at the federal level, marshaling federal power, which was needed because you couldn't trust the states to integrate at all in that period of time. So the apparatus of the federal government was a very powerful apparatus, and it could expand the concept of the New Deal. The forgotten man didn't need to just be a man. It could be a man and a woman, and it extended to all races and everybody's constitutional rights.
There was an earlier black cabinet under the other Roosevelt. That was, I mean, this story is amazing enough. And then when you follow the story of black voting rights, of black participation in government and in society, from, and you trace this in the book, from the Reconstruction to the first Roosevelt Teddy and then to FDR, the overall thing is there's a lot of stuff gained and then it's taken away. And then it's gained and it's taken away. And it's a really like frightening, scary, frustrating story that has positive moments, but there's always this moment where white politicians, the white masses, especially in the South, just go, that's enough. And they find different ways of taking the power away.
I think that's a cycle we see right now, right?
Well, and that's the other thing I want to say about this book is, this book is a very pertinent book to be reading at this moment.
Yeah, I think a lot of their lessons are lessons that we could look back on and learn. And I think that's what you say is right. It's sort of, you jump ahead and then there's this backlash that the civil rights movement, the black freedom movement has to deal with. And it seems to be a pattern, but that pattern could be potentially broken. And I think that's what the black cabinet thought.
Right.
I mean, they were well aware of this kind of push forward, push back. And I think they thought that this is the moment. And I know that there was a belief that if FDR had lived and when the war had ended, that there would be more energy devoted to equal rights. That, again, there was a great faith that possibly the New Deal could be resurrected and redirected into a broader avenues. I think that was definitely Bethune's vision for.
And this is also a history of a tremendous shift in politics. Mm-hmm. Whereas post-Civil War, the Republicans had gained most of the black vote in America. And this is the switch over to the Democrats picking up the black American vote.
Right, and I think that's another reason it's so resonant right now with our era. You have to credit African-American women for bringing African-American people into the Democratic Party. It's Eva DeBoe Jones, who was a manicurist, who worked in the homes, primarily Republicans, but also one of the great Democratic bosses' sister, and she arranged the first meeting between a GOP power broker, Robert Vann, and the Democratic Party, and that was for 32, and that brought a trickle of voters in. But then it's an avalanche in 1936, and in part because of black cabinet members who get out on the campaign trail and campaign for Roosevelt, but also Mary McLeod Bethune, who's, you know, a close friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. She's a longtime educational activist. She's brought into head the National Youth Administration's African American division. She's the first black woman to head a federal agency. And she and Eleanor Roosevelt worked together in the summer of 36 and strategized about how to get on the campaign trail and how to bring African American voters into the Democratic Party. And Bethune's, just her endorsement, Mark, I mean, she was so important in black America. She was recognized as the first lady of black America and also recognized in the United States as one of the most important women in general. Her endorsement of Roosevelt meant everything because she was regarded so highly in the community and people trusted what she had to say. So it's so interesting in this time we talk so often, I hear on the news, black women are the backbone of the Democratic Party.
Right, and that's right. I just heard that today.
Absolutely right. I mean, they have been since the beginning of the modern party that we know now. And it's because of this era in which the black cabinet operated.
I think it's safe to say that Franklin Delano Roosevelt wouldn't have been reelected without the efforts of these people getting out the black vote.
Oh, I think that's right. And I think not only in 36, but in 1940, I think in 1940 you had Wendell Willkie, who was more progressive in ways than Roosevelt. He'd defected from the Democratic Party and become a born-again Republican. And he was actually more open. Roosevelt himself really refused. He didn't endorse anti-lynching legislation openly. He at one point condemned lynching, but he really sidestepped any open endorsement of black causes, and he never acknowledged the black cabinet. In fact, he opposed the organization of a black cabinet. They organized themselves.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the title Black Cabinet. That was not an official title. That was a title they used themselves.
Right, right. That was a title that was originated by black journalists, and it was applied in that in the first group, the Roosevelt-Taft group at the turn of the century. And then people were looking for it to come back. In through the 1920s with the Republicans, people thought the Republicans were going to bring the black cabinet back, but they don't. It's Roosevelt, right? But he doesn't really want to do it. What he's doing is they're eyeing votes. And
FDR is always like sort of the political strategist, where you feel that Eleanor Roosevelt has sort of seen some kind of light, at least.
Right, definitely. I mean, if you compare him, FDR, as Robert Weaver says, is a political animal. Mm. And he's always, if I have a 50% chance or more of winning, then I go for it. And he never believed he had that on race relations, and he was beholden to white Southern Democrats. Eleanor Roosevelt, she had already come over once they were elected in 32, but she was, she's at that point where she is against racism, but she's still got a ways to go. It's Bethune. When Bethune comes in, and their friendship has really blossomed. They knew each other beforehand. Bethune tutors her on becoming an active anti-racist. And it's Eleanor Roosevelt that's the moral conscience of the White House. And she carries that stuff to FDR.
She really brought it to Eleanor personally, so that in her conversations with Eleanor Roosevelt is the first time that I think that Eleanor Roosevelt really started to understand the depth of racism and its effects in America.
Right, right. I think that Mary McLeod Bethune was an incredible communicator as well as an organizer. And I think through Bethune, Eleanor Roosevelt really realized the severity of racism and its impact, and also the possibility that it didn't have to be forever. That's the thing, that you have to get that group of people, those group of whites who are in power, to understand this doesn't have to be forever, and it doesn't have to be so slow. FDR told, according to Bethune, FDR said, there'll be change, but it's going to be slow. I think Eleanor Roosevelt tended to be a bit of a gradualist at the beginning, but more and more believed that it was urgent that America wake up to its racial problems.
Under the New Deal, there were some real problems with wage disparity. Mm-hmm. Between black Americans and white Americans, to the point where the New Deal was causing more poverty initially among blacks.
Right, right.
You got to talk about how that worked, because it was really a complex system about how that stuff got filtered down to society, and black workers got overlooked.
Right.
Or were paid minimal wages.
Yeah, that's the problem, because it is so complicated, people didn't notice. But in the famous first 100 days, right, Mark, nothing comes out that's directed at black people.
Nope.
And in fact, it's all just sucked into white communities and spent out. And so African-American people are completely bypassed. And nobody notices, but you have young Robert Weaver, who will eventually end up a major leader in the black cabinet.
Yep.
He's actually doing economic studies to say, the New Deal is not only not helping, it's actually hurting black people, because it's ignoring them. And then in areas where the New Deal is operating, it's establishing much heralded and needed minimum wages, but black people are exempt from the minimum wages by the New Deal. So that's the big problem. And then on top of it, once the economy starts to recover, you have prices going up. So black people have never recovered, and now the prices are even higher for food. So you're just pounding black people in their communities with poverty, pounding them deeper and deeper into poverty. So this is the message that Weaver and others bring into the White House in late 1933 and say, what you're doing is encoding at the federal level racial discrimination. You're encoding basically Jim Crow practices at the federal level, and we've got to get in here and reverse this. And they do successfully in a lot of ways by presenting a black voice within, but also developing anti-discrimination practices and clauses. And Weaver's really important in saying having a clause isn't enough. You have to have ways to enforce it. And they figure out how to enforce it. So that's so critical, because if they hadn't been there, a lot of what they achieved was by blocking these kinds of things.
It right.
was by stopping the federal government from going down that path of institutionalizing racism even further within society.
It could be difficult to get through to FDR because of White House patronage politics. a lot of the positions were given to white loyalists from below the Mason-Dixon line. This is actually in your own writing. And so there was sort of this solid barrier of white Southerners who controlled the Oval Office.
Right, right. And they're led by FDR's press secretary, Stephen Early.
Yeah.
And the other thing about Early, he's not just a press secretary. He's an advisor to the president. And he came from a journalist's background, so he had ties that FDR needed badly in terms of the press and the broader community. So most of those White House secretaries within the Oval Office, that staff was primarily Southern, and it was done to appease white Southerners. So there's your first blockade. I mean, you can't even get in through that direction. So the Black Cabinet had to use other ways to get to FDR. Almost nobody saw FDR but Bethune. It was Bethune because of her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt.
She strikes me as a person that you could not refuse, because she was pretty adamant. She wouldn't take no for an answer. She was a strong person.
Right, right. That was what she was known. I mean, Bethune faced down the Ku Klux Klan on her college campus in Daytona Beach. I mean, in the 20s.
A lot of times, and she was sick, too, especially in her later years, and she just never gave up.
Mm-mm. No, she was fearless, and despite her health issues, she was energetic. Everybody who met her, if you read about her, remarked on how she was just utterly and completely unforgettable. She had a presence that was unmistakable. You knew when she was in the room. And, the episodes of her lecturing FDR, I mean, she had access to FDR, unlike the others in the cabinet, and she would lecture FDR to his face, wag her finger at him.
Oh, yeah.
And he accepted it.
She didn't FDR sugarcoat it when she was talking to him.
No, no, not at all. So that's Mary McLeod Bethune. But, she's one conduit through the White House domestic staff.
That's right.
Particularly the McDuffies, who were the maid and valet to FDR, who FDR had known since he had a vacation home in Georgia, and he met the McDuffies there. The McDuffies are Black activists themselves, and they're very close to the NAACP. So the McDuffies are another route by which the Black cabinet could get messages to FDR. One of the things was reading about Eleanor. If she couldn't get to FDR sometimes,
right,
she would write little notes and leave them on his nightstand so he could see what Black cabinet requests were.
I just want to make sure we introduce some of the other people. Who's Bill Hasty?
Bill Hasty was a childhood friend of Robert Weaver, a graduate of Harvard Law, brilliant, brilliant attorney, mentored a Thurgood Marshall at Howard Law,
oh, wow,
and came into the Department of Interior and innovated with Weaver the ways in which you could enforce anti-discrimination orders. So it was this brilliant legal mind that he had, and later on goes on to become one of the first federal appellate judges, first person of African descent as a governor of the Virgin Islands. So just a really critical key member of the cabinet. In the war years, he's appointed into the War Department, and the War Department was really, really hostile to his presence.
Oh, yeah.
But he fought so hard in the War Department, eventually won some battles in terms of getting better treatment for Black soldiers and airmen, especially Tuskegee airmen. But in the end, the way he got a lot of what he got was by resigning in protest. He was so respected in the Black community. His resignation spoke volumes and forced the War Department to make concessions.
There were several major accomplishments by the Black cabinet. One of them was the National Youth Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk about what that was? Because that was Bethune's one of her major organizations that she really wanted, or departments. And that was a major accomplishment right there.
Right. Just her appointment as the head of it was a breakthrough for Black people. A Black woman heading a federal program was remarkable in that era. And then for her, because she's an educator, so she comes from an educational background, and education means everything to her. I mean, she was born in poverty and worked as a domestic to get an education. So she knew the value of education, and through the National Youth Administration, she saw the potential to expand educational opportunities to expand training too, hands-on training. Bethune's kind of philosophy of education was you needed vocational training, but you also needed training in the classical sense, training right. in the of the hands and the head. That's what she would talk about. And so through the National Youth Administration, she could bring that sensibility and bring these programs to Black communities. And she traveled the country touring her programs, speaking, and so it served a double purpose. It made the case for her programs and for more funding to her programs. They were some of the best-funded programs for African-Americans.
She also organized we're going to run out of time, and I haven't gotten anywhere yet. She organized the National Conference on the Politics of the Negro and the Negro Youth. That's the title of it. That was an important conference, and it generated something called the Blue Book.
Right. And what's so important about it, Mark, is it's the first time they were federally government-sponsored conferences. They were like mass meetings, and people broke off and talked about every issue that we're still dealing with today.
Yeah.
And the Blue Book was a summary of the major issues that Black America was facing and the major solutions that could be pursued. So it's right there, 1937. Then she had another meeting in 1939. They re-emphasized the solutions in the Blue Book, solutions that could be done in terms of expanding health care, advocating for universal health care, anti-lynching law, which is stymied in the Senate right now.
That still blows my mind.
Voting rights.
Yeah.
All the things are right there. They laid it out. And it's a milestone, though, because never before had the federal government sponsored anything like that. And there it was, right there in Washington, D.C.
You also write, and this is sort of interesting, that participating in the Black Cabinet could be an isolating experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so they often look to each other for support.
Right. This is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job. And so there's the intensity of the job, and then you're often sent out on the road, which is dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Doing programs in the South, you're going into areas where the Ku Klux Klan or some white supremacist group is actively operating and threatening Black people not to participate in New Deal relief. But then back home in Washington, D.C., when you go to the office, Washington, D.C. is a Southern city, and it follows Southern segregationist codes. Jim Crow rules in Washington, D.C., so when they first come in to the federal government, the bathrooms in many of the buildings are segregated. Elevators, you can't take the elevator. You have to go up the freight elevator if you're going to take the elevator. You go to the office. They've not the white lower-level New Deal bosses, they haven't created any office space for you, and they're not particularly welcoming. They don't really want you to do anything. So at the cafeteria, it's segregated. That's what's so great. Weaver and Hasty decide one day, you know what, we're going to desegregate them. They show up at the Department of Interior cafeteria, and they insist on being served.
There were these poker nights
mm-hmm.
where they sort of get together and sort of let out. They played poker, but they also just let off a lot of steam.
Right. It's the poker nights. Weaver's poker nights were famous, and to get invited to the poker nights, not all Black cabinet members attended those. So Al Smith, who was over in the WPA overseeing jobs, he wasn't Ivy League enough really to make the grade. He may have come to a few, but not very often. So it was this elite group within the Black cabinet who got together, and they strategized at poker nights. I have to also say, Mary McLeod Bethune would never attend such a thing.
That's right.
She was far, far too straight-laced to ever go to a poker night. And she knew they were going on, but didn't approve of them necessarily. But yeah, they were a way where people could get together, like you said, blow off steam, share strategies, talk about what Mrs. Bethune wanted, how they were going to do it. So
We just have a few minutes left, and again, we cannot possibly summarize the incredible history that you've written. But mm-hmm. World War II comes up, and there's a huge struggle about integrating the military, getting Black women to be able to enlist in the military. And that's another enormous story in and of itself. And then FDR right. dies, and it's mm-hmm. like everything just disappeared.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mark, though, it was fading out before his death. You could see.
Because of the war? The war was just taking more precedent?
Yeah, they were moving the funding from the New Deal programs, which were primarily where the black advisors were all located and scattered throughout the New Deal. So as they started cutting those programs, they started releasing people. Al Smith, who I didn't get to talk a lot about, but who was so important in getting black jobs, he lost his job really early when they closed the WPA. And the argument that everybody was making is don't close these programs, keep them and institutionalize them because they're going to be important after the war. This recovery is going to only be temporary. So as they shutter those programs, people start to lose their job. Even Bethune loses her job before Roosevelt's death. But Roosevelt's death, I think, marked an end to the idea that maybe that these things could be resurrected. And that's pretty much the case. Truman had a council of black advisors that was unofficial, like the black cabinet that FDR had, but they were never as forceful or as their voices were never as heard as loudly, although Truman did succeed in integrating the army, which was one of the many things that the black cabinet had been fighting for since way before the war. So FDR kind of closes the door of opportunity. But like I said, people had been losing their jobs once the New Deal started to shut down.
And then it all has to start beginning again with the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And then it's beginning all again now. And it seems like it's a constant struggle. Some gains are always made, but then there was always several steps backwards. And that's why this book is so important. I mean, you really have the historical foundation for what people want. I mean, they want representation in the government and participation and equal treatment under the law.
Right. I think that the solutions are all there.
The Blue Book was like an outline of what needed to be done.
What you could do right now. But they're the bridge. You know, there's the earlier generation, Du Bois, Booker T. Washington.
Yep.
And then we know about Martin Luther King and that generation. But there's this forgotten generation, this lost generation, and they're the bridge. They're the ones that lay the blueprint out for action. And I think one of the things they all came to understand is you need voices inside and outside.
That's right.
Because if you can't get traction inside, the black cabinet leaked stuff and worked with activist organizations to pressure FDR and the Congress from the outside. So working on the inside and the outside are really important. I think right now what you have is you have the inside channels are really shut down.
Oh, yeah.
When you have them both working, then you can see the change go forward, right?
And with that, we have to end because we're out of time. In all honesty, I could have talked about this book for several hours because there's so many great details in this. My returning guest tonight, after too long a time, is writer and historian Jill Watts. She's a professor of history at California State University, San Marcos. But we're talking about her new book. And I hate to say you have to read this, but it's a good read and it's a great story. The Black Cabinet, The Untold Story of African Americans in Politics During the Age of Roosevelt. Jill, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, Mark, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.